Case number 13-1026. Goff Properties LP, Balazs Ventures LLC, a partner other than the Tax Matters Partner Appellant versus Commissioner of Internal Revenue Service. Mr. Autry for the appellant, Mr. Dale for the appellee.
May it please the court, Dave Autry on behalf of Goff Properties. The limitations period, which the Supreme Court in Rothiesness recognizes the indispensable element of fairness, expired over 10 years ago on April 17, 2003, for the partnership formed by the same law firm in Home Concrete, as the Supreme Court confirmed, for the partnership that was the companion case to this case, Highwood Partners, which the IRS conceded, and in this case, for three reasons, the government's fifth attempt to extend the statute of limitations for the Goffs only, the Goffs alone, but perhaps everyone else who sought protection against unlimited liability in a large law firm or architectural firm, the government cannot prevail. The government cannot prevail in pretending 10 years after the fact that the Goffs never furnished their name, their common address, and at the same place in Pickens County, South Carolina, for them and all their entities, or their Social Security numbers. In fact, even today, if one listens closely or reads closely the government's brief, I think the government would be forced to say they would take the position that despite all the filings, that identifying information still has not been submitted to the government, and the statute of limitations would be open for everyone back 30 years on these TEFCA partnerships.
What do you say about the IRS regulation that specifies what the contents of the statement has to be?
There is a, you have to read the regulation as a whole. The introduction to that regulation says that the IRS will use the information outlined in the regulation. There is a section in the regulation that contemplates a form would be submitted.
Well, I'm looking at the regulation as a whole.
Yes, sir.
I've got it right here. And it says the statement shall, and then lists five things that have to be included. Where is the wiggle room that you're referring to?
Okay. Now, before we get to F, F has an elastic clause that I think reconciles the regulation with the statute. But, you know, the peculiar thing about C, I believe you may be looking at C, Your Honor, is that the tax court proceeded on the assumption that the government statute, the Goff statute of limitation ought to be extended because they failed to file a form. But the tax court did not realize that the IRS never created the form. We asked six.
Maybe on the wrong regulation. Which?
This is regulation 3.01, excuse me, 301.6223C-1. Uh-huh. All right. And so there is an outline for it.
No, so I'm looking at the regulation at the time. You're looking at the current regulation?
The regulation, there's no material difference on this score between the temporary.
There's a difference in the numbering.
There's a T in the temporary, and there's no T in the permanent.
I don't have a, maybe I'm looking at the wrong one, but I have the same one, but it doesn't have a C1. This is good if we can get this part straight anyway. The part I was referring to is B3, the contents of the statement.
Right. On the contents of the statement, there are two points of interest. One, we say that actual notice trumps hypertechnicalities under a long line of cases, including the construction of this statute, the 6223. In that case, is a case where the government successfully argued that a foot fault doesn't trump, a technical foot fault doesn't trump actual notice. Secondly, actual notice must prevail over hyper-technicalities of these provisions where the government fails to issue the form. Six times we asked the government to name the form that we failed to identify, that we failed to file, and the government can identify no form.
Where does it say there has to be a form? It just says to specify. Again, if we could just focus on this regulation for 1 second. I don't. It may well be a reference to a form somewhere. I just don't see it. It states quite specifically what the content of the statement shall be. But where does it say there has to be some form that you have to file?
Your Honor, and as Tax Court Judge Gokey recognized, when the regulations say statement, that gets translated into a form. Otherwise, the service center can't process it. In his earlier case in Jaffe, he says, well, they're missing the form required by 6223C. So, for example, when the regulations speak in terms of the information that's required of a partnership to be attached to the partnership return, it says statement, but we understand it to mean it's got to be a schedule or a form. There's no form. There's no instructions for the supplying of this information, which we say undergirds the proposition that actual notice must trump.
The word form is not in this regulation.
No,
right?
But statement is understood in the tax law to be translated
into
form.
We'll ask the IRS whether they understand that word in the same way. But it seems very specific about what has to be in the statement.
It does. It does. Yeah. And it attaches a number of non-statutory requirements. For example, the suggestion that you have to say correct or supplement when there's nothing to correct or supplement since.
Are you challenging the form as not being reasonable under Chevron? The regulation as not being reasonable under Chevron? You said it.
I don't think you have to go that far because if you read the for two reasons. If you read the regulation as a whole, that is, you recognize that in F, the IRS may use other information. It's not obligated to conduct a search, but may use other information. That lends itself to actual notice. What we're talking about is the difference between requiring strict compliance with non-statutory provisions as overriding actual notice. Any number of cases in which, first in 6223, the courts have held actual notice trumps a hyper-technical strict construction of this provision, of these provisions.
You referenced F a couple of times, but I'm not quite following that because it may be true that the IRS can rely on other information, but why is that to the exclusion of saying that if we choose not to rely on other information, you need to supply the following five things?
Well, what it says is that, well, first of all, they did rely upon other information here. The Internal Revenue Service issued a summons. It issued a summons for this specific sworn purpose of using the taxpayer identification information to determine the liabilities of these taxpayers. They swore to the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois for that. They got those 480 pages, so they did the search here, and so which brings us under F. And by bringing us under F, that brings us into a reconciled or harmonized reading with the base statute 6229E. Which requires that the one-year period starts from the date that the taxpayer's name, address, and Social Security number are furnished. The passive phrase, are furnished. It doesn't say when it has to be furnished. It doesn't say who it has to be furnished. It's clear under the regs the taxpayer doesn't have to furnish that information. Anyone may furnish that information. It doesn't say
so
how.
So somebody just sends a letter to the head of the IRS. That's good enough?
No. Under actual notice, absolutely. Under actual notice, if you deliver 480 pages of identifying information, that's more than gracious.
480 pages out of how many CDs altogether were there here?
It was the entirety of one CD. There were 1,300 CDs.
So out of the 1,300, because one CD had these two names on it, that's good enough.
And another CD was Home Concrete, which the Supreme Court has ruled is barred by the statute of limitations. Another,
but not based on actual notice.
Well, they did not see, the Supreme Court never saw in the face of these statutes that there was any problem here. No court, no clerk, no advocates suggested there was a problem here.
This issue wasn't addressed in Home Concrete, though.
Well, these statutes were dealt with. I don't assume that the courts didn't read the statutes as a whole. They focused upon one of the earlier four reasons which we defeated is for the extension of the statute of limitations. All right, and so. We say to you that actual notice trumps all other matters. We say to you that there is no form. The IRS here withheld a massive amount of information. To your question, Judge Garland, a letter to the Internal Revenue Service, the back of a cocktail napkin signed by a bartender would satisfy the strict construction, which is not a very practical approach, but that is the position that statement leads to. The fact of the matter is that the IRS withheld the entirety of the strange accountant's firm, strange accountant's files on these taxpayers. They summons the stipulation. They summons all of our files. They withheld those files as they earlier withheld the law firm's files. Any slip of paper within those withheld files by the party who undeniably carries the burden of proof for two separate reasons, they cannot carry their burden of proof and withhold those files.
Do we have a reason to believe there's something in those files on this subject?
I have every reason to believe that there's the taxpayer's name, address, Social Security number, and their complete dealings with this transaction, just as those files.
That had been, I'm sorry, is the idea just that they, because they collected those files as part of a subpoena, that alone is enough, or you think there's something in those files that indicated that there had been a correspondence with the IRS that provided the information? Which of the two of it is are you talking about?
They would be the person, the firm, to correspond with the IRS because they are the return preparers. They're also the accounting firm that handled the entire transaction for the Gauls.
You're not making an argument that if the IRS seizes an accountant's files and your client's name happens to be in the files they've seized, you're not saying that's enough to furnish the information.
I'm saying that is satisfied when the law firm generated their 480 pages. This adds nothing more to that. What I'm saying is that any communications between the accounting firm, the Goffs did not have to provide the communication, any communication between the accounting firm and the IRS and those withheld files would put us out of court.
So you think there might be a correspondence from the accounting firm to the IRS?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. We cannot know the answer to that because the IRS, which bore the burden of proof,
but you don't know of any. You don't know that.
We haven't seen it. We don't. You know, they're strange.
We're hostile. Not whether there is any.
We can only assume that the communication, all communications were handled by the preparer of the return.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Ivan Dale on behalf of the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. I'll just start maybe with the last point that we left off on, this notion that there is some rogue KPMG file out there that contains the smoking gun that the IRS has withheld to this point. The only thing that happened was the appellants were given the opportunity to take discovery on the issue of whether or not this information had been furnished. They did take discovery. They submitted discovery requests. We responded with everything we had. There was no motion to compel. There was no contention order finding that the IRS had withheld any documents.
Are you saying there was no motion to compel the production of the KPMG files?
Right.
Was there a request for them?
The discovery request itself may have specifically referred to KPMG, or it may generically have referred to accounting firms and others that had dealt with the.
Okay. Right. Can you refer on opposing counsel's statement that the word statement in the reg section 301. Is well known in the tax community to mean form. What is the government's position on that?
I'm not aware of that at all. In fact, it's quite common that a statement is required by regulation and there's no corresponding form. For instance, significant transfers to a controlled corporation have to be reported, and the Goffs actually filed a statement in their return for which there was no form. And that statement is on page 582 of the joint appendix, and it sets forth the fact that there was a transfer of property from Andrew Goff to his controlled corporation, Bodacious Inc. That's a statement required by the rules that for which there is no form. There are many others. There's statements that you're supposed to make if you want to avoid penalties with respect to certain tax shelters for which there are no forms. So, no, there's not a form for everything.
The statement on 582 and statements like it, are they filed as attachments to forms, or are they just filed as standalone documents that are statements?
Well, I mean, this particular statement was appended to a tax return, but I see no reason why you couldn't file a separate statement with the service center. That's what the law requires. I don't think the IRS can undo the law by omitting to include space in a form for a particular disclosure.
What do you say about that?
This is your law. It's your regulations.
Well, and it would not have been difficult to comply with, really. I mean, a letter saying, by the way, when we filed that tax return for the Goff LP partnership and we identified these two LLCs as the only partners and we said that they were S corporations, what we really meant was that Andrew and Ann Goff were the partners and these LLCs, single member LLCs, should be disregarded for tax purposes. That's pretty easy to do.
What about the actual notice point?
Well, you know, the law requires that, I mean, the question this court has to answer is whether information identifying Andrew and Nan Goff as the partners in Goff LP was furnished to the secretary. The term furnish means a little bit more than notify. Says to supply what is needed. There's an element of it that suggests that maybe it should be provided to the IRS in a way that the IRS might become aware of that information rather than, I mean, he gave the example of something napkin written and handed to a bartender. That wouldn't work because you can't hand it to the bartender, right?
I don't remember the handing to the bartender. I think he meant write on the bar napkin and send it to the IRS.
Well, yeah, and you know what? That would work. That would be fine. I mean, there's no particular form, but if you wrote it on a napkin, I mean, that's an unusual thing to do, but it complies with the reg.
So why was the information that opposing counsel describes as actual notice not sufficient here?
Well, because it's the question is not whether there was actual notice. The question is whether it was furnished to the secretary, and the secretary means the secretary or his delegate. So by the terms of the statute, it is clear that the IRS can, and it's quite reasonable for the IRS to identify to whom this should be submitted and how this should be submitted in a way to enable the IRS to act accordingly. Because this concept of furnishing to the secretary has more consequences than just the statute of limitations issue. It concerns who is entitled to the notice of the beginning of an administrative proceeding, who is entitled to notice of the FPAW, you know, whether a partner is entitled to a separate determination on partnership items or whether they're bound by a settlement agreement with a tax matters partner. There's a whole cascading effect of things that happen when you furnish partner information to the secretary. It has a legal effect. It's referenced several times in the code. And so to say that, by burying something in, to deliver 1,300 CDs, only one of which contains information relating to the Goffs and their entities, that one CD contains 480 pages, the first couple pages of which explicitly state that Jenkins and Gilchrist is not furnishing this on behalf of the Goffs, that there's no agency relationship between Jenkins and Gilchrist and the Goffs. And it says it's not a statement. It's not it's unsigned. And so it doesn't, there's no reason for the IRS when it gets those 1,300 CDs to think that somehow, Andrew and Nan Goff are supplementing the prior partnership return.
You talked a little bit about the meaning of the word furnish, but I think your argument is not that there's no meaning, there's no definition of the word furnish that would accommodate actual notice. It's that you get to decide based on your authority as the agency, what furnished means in this context. And the way you've chosen to construe the term furnished is it has to specify, it has to satisfy the requirements that you've set out in the regulation.
I suppose so. But, I mean, IRS is a big organization. It has a lot of employees. So there's an element of furnished to the secretary that says it has to be furnished to a particular person or office. You know, you can't just file your tax return by slipping it under the door at, you know, at some IRS office somewhere or, you know, where the janitor works. I mean, you have to file it at a particular place. I mean, you can argue that they have actual notice because somebody that works for the IRS has received this, but it wasn't furnished to the secretary. So, I mean, so the secretary has the right to set forth who needs to receive it, and it quite reasonably says you file it where you file your partnership return, or if, you know, if we've already begun an audit and partnership proceeding, then file it with the person handling the partnership proceeding. And that way, the person who needs to know the information and who will have to send out all these other required notices and do all these additional, take all these additional steps because now there is an identified partner of the partnership, they have that information. And by giving it to a guy that was investigating the promoter liability of Jenkins and Gilchrist and having Jenkins and Gilchrist do it, not on behalf of the Goffs, not acting as an agency of the Goffs, you know, buried within 1,300 CDs and without a statement that says what this is for or this is supplementing a prior return or anything like that, you know, that's not how to go about delivering the information to the person that needs the information.
Before you run out of time, if we could talk about the inconsistency for a moment. So the inconsistency I'm most interested in is the one you described in your brief is inconsistent for Goff LP to claim a $45,000 basis in the currency options, which that would be the inside basis, right? While the Goffs claimed that the options cost them $4.5 million. That would be the outside basis, right? Is that I'm reading from your statement of the summary. Is that an inconsistency that you're talking about?
It's not inconsistent for an inside basis to, I mean, it's not impossible for an inside basis to be inconsistent with an outside basis.
That was going to be my next question.
Right.
So go ahead and explain.
But so what I'm saying is it's inconsistent to claim on the partnership return that the two LLCs contributed property that was worth $45,000 while on the partnership return claiming that the Goffs themselves contributed a property that cost $4.5 million. That's plainly inconsistent, both as to the identity of the contributor, the identity of the partner, and the value of the property being contributed.
So what else goes into the basis here other than the cost? When you said it's inside basis can be inconsistent from the outside basis, is that something that happened here in a way that could have happened here?
No. I mean, you can have adjustments to basis such as property can, depreciate over time or lose its value, and you will take an immediate deduction, and then your outside basis will be reduced. But, I mean, this all happened simultaneously. So the partnership's interest, when the partnership receives partnership property, it takes the basis of the partner, and the basis of the partner and the basis of the partnership at that point should be the same.
Outside basis is not itself part of the partnership return, right?
Right. The partnership has its own basis and its own property.
Sorry, go ahead.
Which is the inside. You're talking about the inside basis, that one?
Yes.
So for the outside basis and inside basis, is it fair to say that the expectation is that they would start out the same? There may be adjustments that then cause one to vary. But in order to be consistent, the IRS's view is that you would start out by assuming that the outside basis and the inside basis match up.
Right. But I want to be clear that our argument regarding the inconsistency isn't so much that there was a basis inconsistency. It isn't from the standpoint of that the partnership did take a loss on this transaction and claimed a $45,000 basis, and that is inconsistent with the $4.5 million basis. But there's other inconsistencies, and one of which, you know, a contribution is a partnership item, and the contributions listed The partnerships said that it received $45,000 worth of contributions, worth of contributed property. Well, at the very same time, you know, the partner is claiming that they contributed property worth $4.5 million.
Is there a difference in whether they're treating this as one transaction or multiple currency transactions?
I think that, I mean, that's one way of explaining it, but that, again, that would be an inconsistency. The partnership's treating it as a single integrated transaction, while the partner's treating it as two completely separate transactions and then not disclosing the second transaction.
Do you have a hesitation? You went away from the inside basis versus outside basis. Is there a reason for that? What's your hesitation?
I noticed the same hesitancy. So,
well, I want the court to know that there are several inconsistencies involved.
But is there more to it than that? I mean, I got that we have that you have like four or five listed, but is there a particular problem?
Well,
the way we've been discussing this, there looks like from your facial expression that there might be. Can you just explain what the problem is?
Inside basis and outside basis is kind of a rabbit hole. I mean, if you read the court's Petaluma decisions and that sort of thing, I don't want to get bogged down in jurisdictional questions, I guess is the matter of my hesitancy with that regard. It's a rather complicated point and one which may be in a little bit of flux, right,
so
because
again,
those appeals are pending.
Say this point in a way that doesn't cause this jurisdictional question to rise in your mind.
That it is inconsistent for the partnership to claim that two LLCs contributed property worth $45,000, while in the partnership return claiming that the Goffs themselves contributed property costing $4.5 million.
Okay.
And that,
brings up the identity of the partners as S corporations versus disregarded entities is an inconsistency, and the identity of the the value of the contribution is inconsistent.
I thought the last point you made, I mean, it's hard not to be technical here because these are technical issues, but I thought the last point you made is the point you've been making. In other words, it sounds like the way you articulated just now is that what you set forth about the $45,000 and the $4.5 million is a predicate to us understanding that there's two inconsistencies that follow from that. One is the S corporation, and the second one what you just said, but I'm not understanding the difference between the second point you just made and the foundational point that leads to it.
Well, I mean, I hopefully, it, you know, I list them separately in the briefs, and I'll say that, there's a distinction between a partnership's basis in its own property and a partnership's capital accounts, which lists, in the capital accounts, starts with the premise of the value of the contributions. That's what that is based upon.
And your view is that it sort of started the contribution. The contribution doesn't, the capital account doesn't have to be the same as the outside basis. They can be different.
Right.
But you're saying that it had to be the same here.
They needed to be reported the same here. I mean, you needed to at least report that the partnership received $4.5 million. In order to be consistent with the partner's return, the partnership needed to report that it had received $4.5 million worth of property, and it assumed a liability of $4.45 million. Because that's how the partners were valuing those transactions. Instead, it just wrapped it all up together and then combined that with some stock and other stuff and put down $300,000 on the return. It's impossible. I mean, I invite the court to look at the partnership return and try and figure out how it is that the IRS was supposed to figure out that what was going in that partnership was a currency option straddle where the partner was disregarding half the basis.
All right, thank you. Is there time left for... I will give you another minute or two.
Thanks. Two quick points. One, the court must choose between actual notice in light of the way that this statute 6223 has been construed and bestowing actual notice is sufficient upon the government in Seneca in light of the fact that the Goffs filed the only form that's available for identifying themselves in the SS4 and therefore in the therefore, when the IRS master filed, that they filed individual returns that ten times referred over to the partnership and its successor by name and Social Security number, and that the Internal Revenue Service, the secretary, exercised its authority, to your point, Judge Srinivasan, by representing to the United States District Court, we're issuing a John Doe summons to get these people's identities for this purpose. That is the sole subject of the John Doe summons.
The purpose being the investigation of J&G or of something else?
That's the perfect question, Your Honor. You read the tax court.
Thank you. I try to get at least one of those in.
The tax court was led to believe it was solely for purposes of pursuing the penalties of J&G. If you look at the definition of a John Doe summons, it doesn't have anything to do with J&G. Its sole function is to pursue the tax liability of the unknown John Doe's. The Internal Revenue Manual confirms that. The sworn statement from the Secretary's designate agent confirms it's solely for the purpose, the John Doe summons is for the purpose of obtaining the identities to pursue the liabilities of the Goffs and the other 1,300 people, one of whom was Home Concrete, one of whom was Highland Partners. Ample authority for actual notice in this arena, especially where there's no form. There's nothing in the partnership instructions to warn somebody, no, you're supposed to be sending in some sort of statement. And, oh, by the way, if there is no form, any statement would do.
Was this summons, IRS summons is signed by an agent, is that right?
It's
an administrative summons.
And approved by the United States District Court.
I understand. But the agent was the agent for the J&G investigation?
He was the agent who was assumed responsibility for both the J&G and for the individuals, as he swore to the court in his affidavit, and as a United States attorney represented to the court in that case. And so in our brief, we try to catalog some of the representations that was the purpose of the John Doe summons.
Okay, you said you had 2 points. You have 28 seconds for the second.
All right. The other point goes to your question, Judge Carlin, about consistency and inconsistency. Every time the government uses the phrase $4.5 million, that's outside basis. This statute says inconsistency in the reporting of a partnership item on the partnership return and the partner return. Outside basis, as this court and four other courts of appeal and perhaps the Supreme Court will soon confirm, is not a partnership item. It is a partner level affected item. The $45,000 was consistently reported on the partnership return. You'll find those exact numbers on the partner returns, and so there's no inconsistency there. The government seeks to draw a contrast in the proper treatment covered by the scholarly amicus brief, as there are different rules on the inside basis.
Which is the statutory section you're referring to?
I'm sorry, on the jurisdictional point?
No, on what has to be consistent and what doesn't.
It is in 6229E, the predicate language speaks in terms of there's an inconsistency in the reporting of a partnership item. Mm-hmm. And clearly, this court above all others.
Is a contribution to the partnership a partnership item?
A contribution to the partnership is a partnership item. It's reported in the capital account at its fair market value, not its tax basis. Nothing on the partnership return reports the tax basis of the contribution.
And this was reported as a contribution of $45,000.
No, actually, I think it was $300,000. The $45,000 is the ultimate loss. There's a $300,000, which is the then fair market value of the contributed property. Fair market value is a completely different concept than the cost basis, and the principal difference is for fair market value, we consider contingent obligations. Any buyer or seller would consider contingent obligations. By law, by well-established Supreme Court authority, we do not consider contingent obligations such as a short option in calculating tax basis. There are different rules that govern those two reportings. They reported it correctly. The government seems to think the fact that the contingent obligation is excluded for tax basis purposes, but included for fair market value purposes.
You say it was reported correctly on the partnership return?
Yes.
Well, I thought you agreed this was a sham for purposes of this argument.
No, on the earlier summary judgment, when the government went, which should have been granted, the government conceded that it should have been granted, we said there's no genuine dispute as a material fact. We don't dispute. We're not going to create a dispute. You say it's a sham. Fine, it's a sham. The statute of limitations is barred. They were then contending that because of a short option, I extension was. That was a concession made for purposes of that motion for summary judgment. It makes no difference here. And for these purposes, the rules are the same. If you assume that you're going to disregard the transactions, that doesn't mean that the rules no longer apply. The inconsistency in the reporting, which at the time they did the transaction, they thought it was all viable. It was subsequently there were case law that suggested that these things were going to be disregarded for want of economic substance. If you disregard it, fine.
That's not a minor thing.
That
sends somebody to jail, doesn't it?
Well, there's a number of. As J Trading was our case, was a conclusion of the Federal Court of Federal Claims, and that reached some of those conclusions. We're trying to get an answer. At the time that court concluded that the prevailing authority was exactly as we say it is. And that is under Helmer, the contingent obligation is excluded for purposes of calculating tax basis, outside basis. There's a jurisdictional gap between the government's contention that there's an inconsistency in the reporting.
Can I ask you this question? Does the partner's basis in the contributed property?
Yes, sir.
That's an item.
The partner.
As to which there could be an inconsistency.
Well, the partner doesn't have a basis. In the internal partnership asset, he has a basis before he contributes.
That seems to be. I think it's best set out in the illustration to the regulation that can be an item as to which there's an inconsistency.
Yeah, and then the question is: there something on the partnership return where he or it reported that property inconsistently, and nowhere does the partnership return report the tax basis of his asset, it goes into his outside basis, which is reported as individual return, but you won't find that on the partnership return. There's not an inconsistency.
Well, but the partnership return has a basis in it that emanates from the basis that the partner brought to
the partnership does have a basis in that property, but there's not an inconsistency in the reporting between that and the partner return.
Well, but there can be.
It could be. I've not seen one pointed to here.
I thought that's the argument part of the argument that the IRS made.
The argument that they're making is that we listed on the capital account section, the Schedule M section of the partnership return, the contribution, and you list it there at fair market value. And the regulations say you list that at fair market value, and it's completely different from tax basis. And so that's their argument. That's a $300,000. Then they're making an argument that there's a little bit of confusion between the 45,000 number on the loss and the fair market value contribution. The contribution was fair market value of 300,000. The loss was 45,000. The loss was reported on the partnership return at 45,000 after the contingency expired, and then it's reported on the individual return at 45,000 precisely. There's complete consistency in the reporting of the 45,000.
I think Judge Srinivasan is referring to the illustration C24. It says, for purposes of its books and records, partnerships needs to determine the basis to the partnership of contributed property, including necessary preliminary determinations such as the partner's basis in the contributed property.
It can be.
It says it needs to be.
Well, but it's not reported under when the points to have an inconsistency, we need to look at the same item on two different returns. That's not being reported. It can be, but it's not.
It's there's no doubt that the Goff's claim $4.5 million as the basis on their individual returns.
Absolutely, that's correct.
And then it seems to me that the argument that's made on basis of this provision that the Chief Judge has pointed to is in their brief, which is that if you look at the partnership return, then it must have been a $45,000 basis because that's the loss.
So that no, Your Honor, the $45,000 reflects is the difference between the long and short option at the time of expiration.
Right. I get that that's what that refers to, but that must have been what the partnership was treating as the inside basis, because that's what's reflected on the return as a loss.
It's the difference between the inside basis on those two positions. We have a long option and we have a short option, and when those two expire, we have a net loss of $45,000, and it's after the contingency expired. But that's consistent with the short option being considered, because you wouldn't get to $45,000 if you.
You would on that, but then with the $4.5 million, the short option just isn't in the field of vision. That's the problem.
For tax basis purposes, it's not.
Right.
But after the contingency expires and there's a net gain upon expiration, the contingency is gone, the net gain or loss is $45,000.
Yeah.
And this is all, for me, mind-boggling. The point of significance, the reason that we hit actual notice as hard as we did, is that it's jurisdictionally complicated. We might need to wait. You might need to wait for the Supreme Court to rule in Woods versus United States on the status of outside bases. And it's been 14 years. This has been cruel for these people. We're looking for the direct answer by going directly to the remedy. It doesn't matter if it's consistent or inconsistent. It makes no difference, because the government had ample evidence. And if the government didn't have ample evidence of the name, address, and Social Security number of these people, then the statute of limitations for every law firm that existed in 1983 and whose partners were well advised to seek double protection against unlimited liability is open today, is reopened back 30 days for every architectural firm, for every accounting firm, for every medical practice.
We have this argument. I'm going to let you sit down for a minute, or more than a minute. I'd like to have a surreply from the government. This is a little unusual, but since we didn't discuss inconsistency with you in your opening, the government didn't know what your argument was going to be, we've just given you 10 extra minutes. I'd just like a few minutes from the government as to what the government's argument is in response about inconsistency.
Thank you.
Inconsistency issue. Thank you. And how this goes to the argument with respect to any partnership item, that is, with respect to that text.
We list four inconsistencies. Number one, the partners were identified as S corporations. So from the standpoint of the partnership return, you have two partners that are S corporations. So you're expecting the S corporations, which are required to file returns on their own, you're expecting to find an S corporation return where things would match up with the partnership.
Which things are we talking
about? The partnership items of Goff LP would be reflected on the S corporation's return. If you were looking for consistent treatment between a partner and its, or partnership and its partners, and the two partners are S corporations, then you would look to the S corporation.
Are you saying because it's an S corporation, they have to report the bases the same way that the LP does?
They have to report partnership items the same way as the LP does.
In terms of their basis, then, is that? Are you saying, because when we were discussing this before, you were saying the inside and outside basis could be different. Not the same.
Right. The partnership does not report the basis of its partners.
Yes, I understand that, but it reports the basis of the assets it has.
Yes.
All right, and does that have to be the
same?
Well,
it does if it's when it sells property.
And that's what it did here, right?
It closed out the options and claimed a $45,000 basis, yes.
So I'm not sure I'm getting the S-Corp point. It's the point that, unlike individuals, the S-Corp has to report the basis in the same way as the LP does, or is that not your point? Why are you emphasizing that they're S-Corps here?
But the point is that when the IRS gets the partnership return, it doesn't have it looks for an S-corporation return. Well, there is no S-corporation return. The Goffs filed an individual return, but they make no reference anywhere in their 80-page filing to these S-corporations. So it's impossible to put the partners together with the partnership.
Now, this isn't the inconsistency that the tax court talked about.
No. But it is one that we raised.
Right, what are the other ones?
It's one that we raised below on page 79 of the response brief. I think there was something in the reply that suggested we didn't. The second one is the partnership treated this as a single integrated transaction. Rather than listing out saying, we received a partnership property worth $4.5 million, and then separately, and there's a point in the tax return where you list these things out separately. At the same time, we assumed a liability of $4.45 million. That should have been that. If you want to report things consistently with the partners, that's how you go about doing that. You list those separately.
Is that a partnership item? Isn't that what the statute requires, consistency with respect to partnership items?
Partnership items include anything, you know, on the return or any premise for the calculation on the return. So, yes, that is a partnership item. What was contributed and liabilities that were assumed by the partnership are partnership items. So they should have said a $4.5 million long option was contributed and a $4.45 million short option was assumed. And that should be on the return. And it's not. Instead, they just balled it together, $45,000, balled that together with some stock that was contributed and some interest on some Deutsche Bank accounts, and said it was $300,000. Again, the purpose is to be opaque a little bit with these, you know, shelters. It's very difficult to look at these returns and figure out exactly what's going on. And eventually somebody did. And the guy that did it was, you know, with respect to the Goffs, figured it out in 2006, the guy that was actually assigned the audit.
Now, this one also is not the difference between treating it as one composite transaction or discrete phases also is not what the task force relied on. And was this one, but you'd raise this one too?
I don't know that it explicitly relied on this. Perhaps it did. It may not have said it the same way that I said it.
So you think this is what the tax court relied on? The tax court, I think, only relied on one consistency.
It relied on contributions and distributions.
Yeah.
So
that's one of your four?
Right. So the third one is what was contributed and what wasn't. And the tax court said, you know, the partners said they contributed something worth $4.5 million, and the partnership said they contributed something that was worth $45,000.
And the other side says, well, one is fair market value and one is cost, and that's appropriate, so that they're not inconsistent. What's the answer to that?
Well, essentially what they're saying is that they bought something worth $45,000 for a price of $4.5 million. I mean, that's the only way that would be consistent,
well, okay.
But that's not...
Well, you heard the rest of his argument. The rest of his argument was about...
I mean, the contributed...
treatment of contingencies. So
right.
What's the answer to that?
The treatment of contingencies. You know, there did used to be a rule that has since been eviscerated from the books and applied retroactively that this sort of loophole that says you're just going to disregard the partnership's assumption of a contingent liability. It's not there anymore.
Say it again. Say that last part again.
There's a regulation on the books now that says that a partnership's assumption of a contingent liability in this context will go to reduce the partner's basis. It wasn't...
That regulation wasn't there at the time.
Wasn't there at the time.
Wow.
They passed the reg, gave it retroactive effect. So, and courts are split on whether that's retroactive effect, whether that's okay to do. Mm-hmm. But the...
So does your argument require us to... If this is the inconsistency on which you rely, then do we have to conclude that the regulation validly imposes this obligation retroactively?
No, and here's why. I mean, just because, you know, two different accounting methods are used doesn't mean there's not an inconsistency there.
I mean, explain that to me. Because suppose, in other words, that the regulation, the world ex ante without the regulation clearly said that you don't have to account for these contingent liabilities.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, then is there an inconsistency? Because the rule is telling you that you don't have to.
Right, but I think you would say, you know, you would say in your partner's return, although the partnership return reports a $45,000 contribution, that's actually comprised of two things, one of which we're not going to regard under the Helmer rule, so, you know, so forth. So that's why our tax basis is $4.5 million for the same thing.
I see. So your view is that they, even if it was correct to count it as $4.5 million because mm-hmm. of this rule on a contingent liability, they still had to tell you what they were.
Mm-hmm. It either needed to show up on the partner return or the partnership return. One.
So that's three of them.
That's three of them. And then the fourth is that there was distributions that were made at the end when they closed it out. The partnership reported $255,000 worth of cash distributions, but Bodacious Inc. reported that it received $4.5 million worth of stock. Or,
but Bodacious Inc. is not the taxpayer here.
No, but they're the taxpayer.
Well, it's a great name, but it's still not
right.
The taxpayer.
Well, they get all the flow through items, all the items on the Bodacious return flows through to the partners. So it's reflected on anything that Bodacious did is reflected on the partner's return.
So I'm sorry to believe this, but on page 55 of your brief.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is captured by one of the four you said, but if so, I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
Third, Goff LP actually used the net premiums paid $45,000 as a basis,
mm-hmm.
calculating the loss and closing out the two options, so that's the partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes on to say, but the Goffs claim through their entities a $4.5 million basis in the options, when they claim the $4.5 million basis in their interest in Goff Enterprises.
Mm-hmm.
That's the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
That's an inconsistency that you're identifying in your brief.
Right.
Where is that in your list?
Is
that one of those?
That is the that's the inconsistency between closing out the options and the partner's return. So when the partnership closes out the options, it takes a $45,000 basis.
Right.
And it assumes the partner's basis.
Right. But the individuals.
And remember, they're only out of pocket $45,000.
Right. But your point is that the inconsistency is in the. Lies in the fact that the individuals claim the basis of $4.5 million,
correct,
close to the $45,000,
correct.
And my question to you is a simple one: you got up and gave us your inconsistencies.
Mm-hmm.
Is what you just said and what we just looked at in this brief one of the things that you described, or
yes.
Is this a fifth one?
No, I think that's one of them. Hopefully I made that clear. Maybe the transcript will.
Okay. All right.
Okay. All right.
Is the fact that these were treated, the transactions were treated inconsistently, is this an inconsistency, or is only the consequence of the way in which they are treated? That is, in one, they were treated as separate, one was treated as integrated.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an inconsistency in a partnership item? Or
yes. Partnership item is defined fairly broadly.
It doesn't have to be something that's on the form. You know, the treatment wouldn't itself be on the form.
Well, if you look at the definition, it includes, you know, not only the items of income loss itself, but it includes the premises that underlie those.
I say the term partnership item includes the accounting practices, the legal and factual determinations that underlie the determination, et cetera.
Right.
I see. All right. Thank you very much. I think we've had enough tax for the day. We'll take the matter under submission. Call the next case.